Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. Bitcoin's 8% plunge just days before the great Bitcoin halvening. The what? The geopolitics and the leverage in play with Galaxy Digital's Mike Novogratz.
If the stock market was open on Saturday night, the S&P would have been down 2 to 3%.
I don't disagree. The question then is, why is Bitcoin not back at 70,000?
Separate House votes for foreign aid funding. Punchbowl's Jake Sherman on the Speaker's floor strategy.
The majority of the House of Representatives is in favor of Ukraine aid. It is in favor of aid to Israel.
And the gamble.
Republicans are, in this bill, planning to do things like ban TikTok, sell off seized Russian assets. So this is a big package and a big moment for Mike Johnson.
And is Trump media unmemeable? Semaphore's Liz Hoffman.
It's like, why does anyone own this stock?
All that plus the rest of today's stories that got us squawking. It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We're live from the Nasdaq market site in Times Square. I'm Melissa Lee along with Andrew Ross Sorkin. He's getting mic'd up right now. Joe and Becky are off today. He'll be with us in just a moment. Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning to you.
It's nice to see you. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he plans to split an aid package for Israel, Ukraine, and other American allies into separate bills. It's a move designed to end a months-long GOP blockade on assistance to Ukraine and respond quickly to Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend. Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene has threatened to force a vote on deposing the speaker if the House considers any Ukraine aid. The congresswoman said yesterday she has not decided whether to proceed with an ouster vote. Speaker Johnson says he anticipates the House will vote on the aid bills on Friday. Joining us now, Punchbowl News co-founder Jake Sherman. He's also an NBC News and MSNBC political contributor. Jake, great to have you with us. Is the speaker's fate really hanging in the balance here?
Absolutely. There's been a group of Republicans for a long time that have suggested that if Johnson puts any Ukraine aid on the floor, his job would be in danger. And I think that that's still a very much a live option. Now, the question is a few things. Number one, do they want to replace a speaker again? Do they want to replace a speaker in the middle of an election season when that speaker is raising money for the party? He raised $20 million last quarter for House Republicans. That's a very important job, probably a good 50% of what he has to do. And to be honest with you, the majority of the House of Representatives is in favor of Ukraine aid. It is in favor of aid to Israel, especially after the Iranian attacks on Israel, and is in favor of aid to Taiwan. So these are our three big priorities. And on top of that, Republicans are in this bill, they're planning to, we'll see if it's able to happen, planning to do things like ban TikTok, sell off seized Russian assets. So this is a big package and a big moment for Mike Johnson and the House of Representatives.
That's a lot of things lumped into one. Andrew and I are looking at each other just in bewilderment how efficient Congress is, I guess, in one respect, lumping everything together to get everything done at once. But the likelihood of anything getting done then diminishes, Jake. What actually do you think, aid to Israel would be on the forefront, given what is going on right now in our sort of awaiting Israel's response to the Iranian retaliation over the weekend. And I don't know if Ukraine will then make it shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, listen, all of these have to pass individually. They're mm-hmm. all individual votes. They'll all need 218 or the votes, the majority of the House of Representatives. But to be honest with you, it's all a big open question as to what passes in this package and what gets knocked out. If I were a gambling man today, I'd say all three, Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, will get through, because Republicans and Democrats are going to have to pair together to vote through all of these and to get it to the Senate for a chance for it to get signed by Joe Biden. But listen, Mike Johnson's been putting off this decision now for months and months and months, and he has a good number of House Republicans who are frustrated with him and are frustrated with his indecision and the speed with which he makes decisions, which is extraordinarily slow compared to previous speakers, especially people like Nancy Pelosi, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, who tended to move with speed when passing legislation. So this has been a long time coming. Mike Johnson was a Ukraine skeptic when he was in the rank and file. Now he's pro-Ukraine aid with some with some caveats. So I would say this does get over the finish line. It's going to be a really rocky week, though.
Jake, if it does get over the finish line, does he still have his job when it's over? Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, I imagine, are gonna do everything they can to throw him over. No?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Andrew. I think it's an open question. I mean, the larger question is, do Democrats, so you need half of the House on the floor to remain speaker. So that's 218 votes given, depending on what the attendance is that day. Democrats have signaled that they would save him from Republicans. They would vote for him or not vote at all if he did the quote-unquote right thing when it came to Ukraine. Now, I think this would qualify as the right thing, most likely. We'll have to see if the proof is in the text, which we should see later today. And the larger question is it sustainable as a Republican to remain in power on the backs of Democrats? And I think that's an open question. But, Andrew, I'll be honest with you. Mike Johnson has no majority. He has a one-seat cushion on every vote. The times have changed on Capitol Hill. It was unthinkable just a couple of years ago that a speaker would survive on Democratic votes. But that looks to be what Mike Johnson will do should Republicans move against him.
Jake, thank you. Jake Sherman. Some lawmakers in Washington want the NASDAQ to delist some Chinese companies over technology that could pose a national security risk. Emily Wilkins joins us now with more. Emily.
Hey, Melissa. Well, yeah, a group of lawmakers are encouraging NASDAQ to delist Chinese companies that have been blacklisted by the Defense Department. In a letter first seen by CNBC, lawmakers from GOP leadership and the Select Committee on China are sounding the alarm that Chinese company Heisei Group has raised over $190 million while assisting the Chinese Communist Party's military. The LiDAR company uses lasers to measure the speed and distance of physical objects, and they make up about 47% of the global market on LiDAR technology. Congresswoman Ashley Hinson, who's a member of the Select Committee and who led the letter, said the funds went toward building a mega factory in China designed to help the People's Liberation Army target U.S. systems and access military equipment. In a quote, she said that unwittingly funding the Chinese military, and she is looking forward to working with NASDAQ to delist Heisei and protect U.S. investors from companies that pose a risk to our privacy and our national security. Now, also on this letter is the outgoing chair of the Select Committee on the CCP, Mike Gallagher, plus the incoming chair, John Molinar, plus Elise Stefanik, who is the chair of the House GOP conference and a rumored potential VP contender for Donald Trump. Now, the group is requesting that NASDAQ respond to the questions about their policies around blacklisted companies in the next 30 days. And we know that they're hoping that this starts a conversation, and we will see exactly where that conversation goes, guys.
I'm just curious, Emily, do you know how long Heisei has been a publicly listed company in the United States? And I guess I'm just trying to understand at what point did it become apparent to lawmakers that this was going on, and what sort of proof do they have that the money is actually being used for that purpose of targeting U.S. potential targets?
So a number of these things have actually been quite recent. Heisei has only been on trading on there since early 2023. And you actually saw the Select Committee on the CCP actually take up this issue previous years. They came out with another letter basically asking the DOD to put companies like Heisei on that list to begin with. So this is something the committee's really been tracking as far as these advanced technology companies. And mind you, this technology is already being used in the U.S. You've seen it in EVs. You've seen it in smart cities, things like bridges, traffic lights, being able to sense the cars in the area. And so I think that's part of where this concern from the committee is coming for, and part of the reason why they think that there needs to be a fuller picture at how groups like the NASDAQ handle companies like this one.
It seems like it might be a little bit too late. I mean, given that they have 47% market share, and as you mentioned, their technology, the LiDAR technology, is being used in lots of applications that are here in the United States. The concern, I would think, would be a national security one on the technology front in terms of them having access to some data, et cetera, from the LiDAR that is currently being deployed.
It's a great point, Melissa. I mean, yes, to a certain extent, the technology is already there. The market share is already there. But I think a lot of the folks on the committee would say, you know, it might just be one company now, but we have to be aware of other companies coming up in the future, other Chinese technology companies, other advancements that they're making. I mean, so often on Capitol Hill, when you hear discussions about technology, you hear discussions about AI, a lot of it does center around the fact that if the U.S. does not sort of keep up with what's going on and keep up with the latest technologies, we could potentially fall behind other countries like China. That's something that's very much on the minds of lawmakers.
Emily, thank you. Emily Wilkins in D.C.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, Galaxy Digital's Mike Novogratz.
When things are bad and people are scared, people with leverage want less leverage. So they take where they have leverage and they sell it.
Iran's attack on Israel took a bite out of Bitcoin, but the crypto investor says, keep calm.
You saw over $1 billion of liquidations on Saturday night. That's retail people who have leverage bets on crypto exchanges that get wiped out.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This is Squawk Pod.
Up and Andrew, Q.
You're watching Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Melissa Lee this morning. Joe and Becky are off. Bitcoin slightly higher this morning. Right now you're at $62,878. This coming following Iran's attack on Israel that sent the cryptocurrency lower. Joining us in an exclusive interview this morning is Galaxy Digital CEO Mike Novogratz. Mike, it's great to see you. We've been talking about it now for the last 2 days and even over the weekend. What precipitated this drop and how folks should think about Bitcoin specifically in the context of being either a safe haven or a hedge against inflation or whatever you think the thesis is for Bitcoin at a time where it has not held up in the midst of at what you would have thought would have been the moment that it would have.
Well, listen, you can always look with really myopic eyes at price action and try to read too much into it. The reality is Bitcoin is, you know, started the year at 42,000 and we're at 62,000. So it's one of the best performing assets. You know, Saturday, Iran attacks Israel. The only asset that's open is Bitcoin. People are very long risk assets in general, stocks, crypto, other things. And so the natural reaction is to go to the safe. And safe is still globally dollars and T-bills. Right. You're seeing the dollar rally. The other bigger.
But isn't the dollar not supposed to be safe? Isn't the whole point of Bitcoin that the dollar is not safe?
Well, listen, in time, it isn't. Right. I mean, look what we're doing now. We're going to vote today to spend more money on wars. Right. President Biden is slipping in more money around the Supreme Court to pay off student loans. We have.
Well, that may be. But the point is that it appears that when things are bad and people are scared, they buy dollars. So
when things are bad and people are scared, people with leverage want less leverage. And so they take where they have leverage and they sell it. It's why stocks are going to look at the Nasdaq chart. It does not look good, right? The Nasdaq's had an amazing.
The whole point of Bitcoin, and we could roll tapes of you and I having conversations for the last 5 or 8 or more years about this, is that it's not supposed to be correlated. That's the whole point of this exercise.
Listen, there's not one asset in the world that is not correlated all the time, right? What happens is portfolios grow, and then a new piece of information comes up, and fund managers, retail accounts want to have less risk, not more risk. And when something has gone from 40 to 70, there's a lot of risk built into it. There's a lot of leverage built into it. And you can see it with the meme coin phenomena. You can see it with other cryptos. Lots of money pours in and animal spirits take over. And so you've got to wash out those animal spirits. It doesn't invalidate this overall thesis.
Can you tell from the flows how much of this selling is a function of folks who were actually selling the underlying Bitcoins directly versus those who were playing in this new world called the Bitcoin ETF?
I think very little in the ETF, right? Most of the ETF buyers are buying for the first time and they're putting it away as a part of their portfolio allocation. And so you've got, you know, these nine companies out there selling Bitcoin to new investors in lots of ways. And so I think most of those are hodlers. You look, though, like this ecosystem has been around since, you know, 2009 and really in earnest since 2017. There are tons of ways you can get leverage in crypto. And that leverage builds up when people feel good about the space and then it gets whacked. And so you saw, you know, over $1 billion of liquidations on Saturday night. That's retail people who have leverage bets on crypto exchanges that get wiped out, right? It's not big hedge funds coming in and selling on Saturday night or institutional investors coming in and selling on Saturday night.
Part of the flight from Bitcoin over the weekend, Mike, might have been that the, you know, the asset rallied basically ahead of the halving, which is happening in just a few days on the 20th of April. And I'm wondering if you think that much of the rally, unlike, you know, people will point to past halvings and what happens to Bitcoin in the wake of past halvings, you know, 12 months out, 24 months out, and this, and Bitcoin always has gone up. This time around, people know that already. Has the rally already happened, in your view?
Listen, I said this the last time I was on and the time before. After a huge move, most likely the next chapter is price consolidation. And I had said, you know, 57 to 70, we're still broadly in that range. I think that range holds. I do think we end the year higher. Like, a lot of the big platforms haven't even started selling yet. They had to wait. They had a season. They had to get approvals. And so you're seeing these platforms that are just going out now to their investors. And so I really still believe that the baby boomers have a lot more money to put in this. And I just don't believe either candidate is going to come out as fiscally responsible. Like, we have a 6.5% budget deficit in a year where inflation, all the inflation indicators are pointing back higher. We've got broadly full employment or close to it in a pretty robust economy. We have a robust economy partly because the government can't stop spending money. And so that story doesn't play well for inflation in the long run, and hence, you know, what I'll call hard assets. Look at gold, silver. You know, I think gold, silver, Bitcoin, copper, all end the year much higher.
I guess where I'm at, and by the way, it may be that Bitcoin's going to go much higher, significantly higher. I don't know. But the reason I've been asking you these questions is I feel like, I hate to say it, I feel like you're telling me the sky is green to some degree, because these conversations all the time about the thesis behind Bitcoin. You're talking about spending and inflation. That hasn't gone away. If anything, it's actually gotten worse over the weekend.
But
you think the war would escalate, people would spend more money.
The reaction function is going away. We went from 7 Fed rate cuts to less than 2, right? And so if you think about it, that's Chairman Powell raising rates, right? There's no other way to think about it. And so when a central bank is raising rates, it's shocking these assets aren't lower. It's telling you how much demand there is when the macro story should be pushing assets lower, right? People don't believe. People are starting to say, what are we doing here? Why is Powell talking about cutting rates when he should be at least holding them steady and talking hawkish, right? What do you think the gold chart, the silver chart, the copper chart, the oil chart is saying about future inflation? And we have a central bank that's, you know, at best wishy-washy, but still talking about rate cuts. And so you know, you've got to kind of hold this all in context. This has been a rate rise, which is shocking how strong the stock market is, shocking how strong assets are. Why? Because they're not as strong in they're higher in dollar price, right? The dollar
is the piece I don't know. Okay, one last thing. We talk about first you said it's correlated to the stock market, but then it's not correlated to the stock market, because on Monday the stock market actually went up quite materially on the back of the idea that maybe actually this war was not going to escalate.
Well,
and yet
Bitcoin
has not moved in the same direction.
But Bitcoin went right back. By in the morning when the stock market was on the highs, Bitcoin was back to unchanged on, you know, we were right back to 67,000. Stock market closed pretty poorly yesterday, and I bet you it closes poorly today. right? I mean, so, you know, you've got to be careful on, if the stock market was open on Saturday night, the S&P would have been down 2 to 3%. It would have, right? There was lots of fear. Is this going to escalate into a real war? Are one of those missiles going to get through and blow something up?
I don't disagree. The question then is, why is Bitcoin not back at 70,000? Unless you think everybody was selling because they needed to pay their taxes.
Well, there's a bunch of reasons, right? And it did bounce up, and then people sold again. People were very long, right? And sometimes you've just got to work through the overhang, right? This right. Bitcoin became the number one story other than Nvidia this year, right? And look at its performance. And so that draws a lot of people in. In all markets, you wash people out, and then the trend continues again.
Right. Mike Novogratz, it is always good to talk to you and to learn from you and to try to understand what's going on here. And I'm sure we'll continue learning and having that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next on Squawk Pod, Trump media stock down quite a bit this week after announcing a plan to issue more shares. But who's buying them? We'll check in with Semaphore's Liz Hoffman.
This is a company that's just like incredibly volatile, not that good at explaining anything it's doing, and heavily owned by retail investors who don't really know what's going on.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod.
This is an assault on America.
Today with Andrew Ross Sorkin and Melissa Lee.
And the first day of jury selection in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial concluded yesterday without any jurors being seated just yet. Trump walked out of the courtroom and addressed a camera.
There is no case, and they've said it. People that don't necessarily follow or like Donald Trump said this is an outrage that this case was brought. This is political persecution. This is a persecution like never before. Nobody's ever seen anything like it.
Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records in connection to the alleged hush money payments made on his behalf to porn actress Stormy Daniels. Now, meantime, shares of Trump Media closing lower by more than 18% again yesterday. This after the company filed plans to issue more stock. That stock has fallen now more than 60% from its recent high after the SPAC merger in March. The company will also seek to offer the resale of up to 146 million shares of stock from, quote, selling security holders, including Donald Trump. Now, Trump remains subject to a six-month lockup period, which expires in late September. And as we discussed on the broadcast, when that filing came over, it's not that he's now been, you know, the lockup has not expired. It's just that they're getting their ducks in a row, I believe, so that they can potentially open up that window for him. So
right.
We'll see.
And the paper value, at least, of everything that he's owned in this media venture has gone down significantly in the meantime since
the
debut.
If the goal is to get him cash, mm-hmm. If that's what the goal is, and if you go on Reddit and whatnot to try to understand, there are people who are really, this is like a financing mechanism.
Oh, yeah.
For him. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, if the value keeps going and it down, and if he can't get the money till September, and, you know, it's another 50% down, that's not helpful. Liz Hoffman is here, Semaphore business and finance editor and a CNBC contributor. She's got a big conference coming up in Washington, D.C. later this week. So congratulations ahead of that.
Thank you.
But let's talk about when you saw that filing, what you think that filing is even trying to say.
I don't know. I mean, I've read it a couple times now. I think ultimately it's actually not, they're not issuing new stock. They're registering some warrants that were sort of already baked into the pie. But again, like, this is a company that just like incredibly volatile, not that good at explaining anything it's doing and heavily owned by retail investors who don't really know what's going on, which is how you end up with a move like that.
So, but I think the big question is, when do we think that this board, if the board is going to decide to allow the former president or others to sell their shares before the 6-month window, how does that work? What kind of disclosure would be necessary? Does the stock move up or down on that news? I mean, I think these are the things that I think people who are invested in this are trying to figure out. And then the question is, what it means to be invested in this company.
Right. So for the, which way it moves, like you can make a case for either way, right? Like it floods the market with new shares, which should generally depress the price. But actually, there isn't. This is a hard stock somehow to get your hands on because there just isn't a lot of it. So you could see it, you know, creating a buying swell that kind of brings the whole thing up. I don't know. I mean, God, the shareholder lawsuits that would immediately follow waiving a lockup. I mean, you can do it, but I think it'd be pretty messy. But then I think to the point you're trying to make, it's like, why does anyone own this stock? This is a company with a single product that not that many people use. It has been losing money hand over fist. I'm not surprised. Eventually, I think you'll see them issue new equity because they're going to have to. I mean,
right.
It was $60 million last year, I think.
Doesn't this allow them to get around the issue of the waiver? I mean, if it effectively brings forward some sales. And so it's to your point about, you know, like an uprising, if a waiver were granted, it being so unfair, et cetera, this actually allows them to sort of get around that.
I think what it does is it would allow him to be, the president, President Trump, to be more liquid in that it's converting some warrants into stock that he could perhaps borrow against.
Mm-hmm.
That's one piece we haven't really talked about and seen. There hasn't been a lot of disclosure, but there's a big slug of stock worth still probably $1 billion, right. $2 billion that he could borrow against.
Look, there are people that you can find on Reddit and elsewhere who actually talk about this, not as a meme stock or as an investment, but actually as a financing vehicle. Literally a campaign financing vehicle.
You know the beauty of that,
a transfer of wealth from the investor community could be effectively a donor who's saying, I'm effectively donating my funds to the former president by investing in this stock such that he can then sell his shares later to be used for the campaign.
And the beauty of that is that if you lose money, you take the loss. So you can donate money.
Right.
The stock goes up. You're like, oh, yeah, I'm supporting President Trump. That's exactly what I want to do. Stock goes down. You lose money.
Right.
And you take the loss.
But again, it's a little hard to tell. Like, again, you can donate to President Trump's campaign if you want to, but you could take the loss. But then are we assuming these are really sophisticated investors who are doing like tax loss harvesting?
I don't really know.
But
I'm just saying that that's
well, I think
totally
what we need to watch for, by the way, is if, in fact, the stock actually moves higher in a meaningful way, could it be that there are a bunch of people, very wealthy people, possibly people from outside the country or others, who actually literally are pushing the stock up? Meaning, it's not an investment. It really is a way to actually transfer wealth. Rather than just being a retail investor, which I always think when we use that phrase, it's sort of dismissive, but it shouldn't be.
I mean, for the moment, this thing is still trading to me like a meme stock. And,
right.
You know, it's going to be 6 months out from an election. I would expect it to be a bit of a heartbeat for the campaign. But, you know, this is more broadly, I haven't totally understood the business case for these kind of ideological echo chambers. You've seen Parler, Gab, Rumble, like they were all supposed to be the next big thing. And I don't think they are. And even more broadly, you know, Public Square, kind of the America First marketplace, you know, it was worth $20 a share. Now it's down under $5.
Right.
Like, I think if you're going to try to own the libs, these things are kind of built on conflict.
Oh, well, let me ask you this. So if Joe were here, and Joe and I disagree about this, Joe has made the argument, and you can say it's right or wrong, and it's unfair that he's not sitting here to talk to you about it. He would say, well, what about the prospect that if, in fact, the former president becomes the president and decides that this is the only platform he's going to use to communicate with the American public, will, in fact, more people start to sign up to live on Truth Social so that they can either interact with or hear directly from the president? And is that something that is potentially monetizable later on?
We all would.
The journalistic community would.
At the very least.
But why hasn't he done that already? If this is so key to financing his
Well, he does that already.
He does that already.
And by the way, a lot of folks in the journalistic community are not signed up for it. So it's not necessarily.
He's not president right now. So.
And ultimately, I mean, there's sort of a Twitter clone for this. And I don't know. I think these echo chambers where you're sort of speaking to your own people, like they just haven't gotten the currency and the eyeballs that have been monetizable so far.
Okay. Talk about for just a quick second, the Semaphore echo chamber for a second, which is that you have a big conference coming up that hopefully won't be just an echo chamber. It will be broader than that. In Washington, D.C., on the back or the sidelines, if you will, of this big IMF meeting.
Yeah, at the World Economy Summit, headed down after this. We've got like 7 cabinet secretaries, 20 CEOs, central bankers from all over the world. And I think trying to answer the question, you know, we've seen 3 or 4 years now of people just pulling playbooks off the shelf. And now they're trying to put them back, and it's not going that well. So I'll be talking to Jeremy Hunt, mm-hmm. Chancellor of the Exchequer and the German finance minister, trying to figure out, you know, Europe hasn't grown in 18 months, like what we're doing here, and try to frankly squeeze some answers out of them.
Cool. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what you got.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thanks to Melissa Lee for sitting in today. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern and get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears when you follow Squawk Pod, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.